Warren Buffett, BlackRock, and other institutional players dominate investments in commercial aviation. Why? Because it's one of the most profitable and predictable alternative assets that exists. And it's not tied to other markets, such as real estate and the stock market. Is it safe? Well, imagine triple net leases to the likes of American Airlines and British Airways. Income is contractual and guaranteed by some of the biggest named airlines in the world. That's why this kind of investment was never available to the ordinary accredited investor. That is until now. Visit accesswealthaviation.com and check it out for yourself. Invest in an institutional team with over 200 plus years of combined investment experience in the aviation sector. Conservative investing with double-digit returns and tax advantages. That's accesswealthaviation.com, accesswealthaviation.com.
You are listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast with Buck Joffrey. Get ready to change your life.
Welcome, everybody. This is Buck Joffrey with the Wealth Formula Podcast coming to you from Montecito, California. And today, before I begin, I want to remind you that there's a website associated with this podcast. It's wealthformula.com. And if you want to participate in any of our upcoming deal flow or want to potentially get some of the resources that are not available on the podcast itself, that's where you want to head. Specifically, you may want to consider joining the Investor Club, the Accredited Investor Club, if you have not done so and you are an accredited investor. Now, you may see deal flow on our regular lists. However, those typically are of a certain variety that we can actually show to non-accredited investors, but only accredited investors can invest. But there is another set of investments that are only privately within that investor club group. And so if you want to sign up for that, make sure you go to wealthformula.com. Today's show is a interesting one. I had a really fun conversation with this guest who talked about Ray Dalio, and it made me think, about my own situation. Okay, here's the deal. I'll be completely frank with you. My social life kind of sucks right now. I moved to Montecito in 2017 from Chicago, and at that time, I was married, had three little girls, and when you got here, like everybody else, you know, we didn't know anybody, and I didn't know anyone, and luckily, I had my family. And was frankly plenty entertained by my three little girls. My now ex-wife also served as a social coordinator, and many of you men out there know how that goes. Then the beginning of COVID happened. My marriage came to an end. And then since moving to Montecito, as it turned out, I'd really just been working from home on businesses that had become very successful, but, you know, I hadn't worked on my social life at all because that had, that had been outsourced or neglected and put on the back burner. And of course, again, that is probably something that, you know, a number of you feel like, you know, that's kind of where you're at. Like you work from home, but then ultimately maybe you have somebody who keeps you, you know, your spouse keeps your social life alive. Anyway, I entered COVID isolation with almost no community or outside or life outside of business. And needless to say, it was a lonely time. And the only good thing that came from it really was a lot of success in those businesses that had really started since 2017. The thing is that, you know, COVID for the most part, this whole COVID thing, it's been over for the isolation part, at least, has been over for, you know, about a year or more. And that excuse is gone. And the truth of the matter is that my social life still pretty much sucks. I have not been successful in that aspect of my life. That is an admission. Okay. So I'm not a good person to tell you how to create a successful social life and will not be writing a book about that anytime soon. So why am I telling you all this anyway? I mean, I'm not telling you this as some sort of suicide note or something like that. I'm too busy with my longevity podcast trying to figure out how to live longer. So that's not the point. what I'm trying to do here is simply to illustrate to you, using my own example, that you can be wildly successful in one aspect of your life and abject failure in other parts. And it's, you know, and that's just the way it normally goes. And the funny thing is that for anyone successful out there, and I mean externally, you're watching them on TV, you're reading books about them, it's really difficult to assess what's really going on there, right? I mean, take a look at Tony Robbins. He's a success, right? He's a great communicator. No doubt he's helped a lot of people, made a lot of money. I have a lot of respect for Tony Robbins. But you know what? He's also been married a couple times, more than a couple times, I think three times. And who knows how his relationships are with his children and other stuff like that? We don't know. But if Tony Robbins wrote a book on marital bliss, guess what? It would be a New York Times bestseller. Why? Because he's Tony Robbins and he is a successful guy. And that's what people want. They want to listen to successful people because it's easier just to look at as an individual as a success rather than trying to pull them apart. And as you know, and as I know, that there's in any given individual, there is a lot of complexity there, right? But it's just, you know, it's easier when you look at these people on the screen or famous people, whatever, just to see them as a single monolithic kind of character, a successful character. Okay. So why do I bring this up? Well, let's talk. We're going to talk today about legendary hedge fund manager Ray Dalio. Now, he's written multiple books on what he calls principles. Okay. So he had principles of investing and then he had one on, you know, life in general. And I will say this is that, you know, whatever is said in this podcast, there's no question that Ray Dalio is certainly qualified as anyone else to talk about money. I mean, he's done, you know, really well for people and he has been successful, no doubt about that. But he writes this book, Principles, that just about life in general. What do we know about Ray Dalio that would make us think that he is successful in anything else? In fact, I would say that what we know right now, there are plenty of people who've worked with and for him who consider his principles outside of investing to be a failure at best and maybe even downright fraudulent at worst, right? So why would people buy books from Ray Dalio that don't involve money? Because again, he's a hugely successful person and people want to learn how to be successful. The challenge for everyone, including me, is to look at godlike figures and understand that they are human with all sorts of flaws. And while we may be able to learn some things from them, which they excel at least, we shouldn't translate success in certain parts of their lives to suggest that they got it all figured out. And my guest on Wealth Formula Podcast today, he actually went out and wrote a book on Ray Dalio. And he tells the story of a man who may be quite different from the image that he actually creates for himself. And it certainly pushed a lot of buttons on Ray Dalio as he actually threatened to sue this guy and actually threw a bunch of fiery accusations back at him. It is a truly fascinating story. This is a fun listen. So make sure you listen to Rob Copeland, who's the author who has pissed off Ray Dalio after these messages.
What do the Rothschilds, the Romneys, and the billionaire hedge fund managers know that you don't about growing and protecting wealth? As you might imagine, the wealthy have a few tricks up their sleeves. One strategy allows you to grow wealth tax-free at a compounding rate with no volatility. It protects your money from creditors and lawsuits, and it lets you invest the same money in two different places at the same time. How about that for amplifying wealth? To learn more, go to wealthformulabanking.com. Again, that's wealthformulabanking.com.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. Today, my guest on Wealth Formula Podcast is Rob Copeland. Rob is a finance reporter for the New York Times. He was previously the longtime hedge fund beat reporter at the Wall Street Journal and has also covered Silicon Valley and the hidden worlds of the wealthy and powerful. He is the author of The Fund, Ray Dalio, Bridgewater Associates, and the Unraveling of a Wall Street Legend. Rob, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so this is a fascinating topic. So let's start with this topic. Well, I mean, why write a book about, well, first of all, maybe just for people who don't know, because not everybody's sitting there looking at who the greatest hedge fund managers of all time and all that kind of thing, but maybe just tell us a little bit about who Ray Dalio is and why you decided to write a book about him.
Sure. And, you know, I would probably agree with someone who doesn't spend their whole life thinking about hedge fund managers, because I don't either.
Yeah.
The fascinating thing about Ray is that though he's the founder of the world's biggest hedge fund, Bridgewater Associates, he's really become famous as more of a self-help guru.
Yeah.
He's over the last two decades, he's made a name for himself for these so-called principles. He wrote a book called Principles, Life and Work, and he's had TED Talks and been interviewed by everyone on earth. And what he essentially says is these rules that made me rich and famous, if you follow them, you too can be rich too.
Right.
And sort of the reveal and the fun of the book is that, of course, behind closed doors, he's nothing like the character that he plays in all of those interviews.
Yeah. Okay. So what got you interested in writing this? Like what's the background here?
So like, frankly, many people, when I first heard of Ray Dalio, I was interested in it because I said, well, this guy seems to have something different about him. The principles that he talks about so much are all about, you know, speaking honestly. And his famous one is pain plus reflection equals progress. So I found there's something honestly appealing about his whole outlook on life. And then, you know, as a journalist, it's my job not just to talk to the firm founder, but to talk to, you know, everyone around him. And just the more famous he got and the more he kept talking about the principles, the bigger the divergence between what he was talking about and what he was actually like. It sort of, by the time I decided to write the book, there really have been two Ray Dalios. There's the character he plays, and there's the truth of it. And so that makes for a really fun book.
Okay. So let's start with what maybe some of the highlights of the external character, this character that's projecting out and writing books and, you know, talking about principles. Give us sort of the highlights of what that person was projected out to the world.
If you listen to Ray Dalio's version of Ray Dalio, he is sort of this generous multi-billionaire with lessons to teach the world. So he's already a billionaire by the mid-2000s as a hedge fund manager, and he comes up with these things called principles to explain his success. He becomes incredibly famous in 2008 because he's able to say that he predicted the housing crash, which, as I get to it in the book, is not necessarily the full story. But the reason that he's become, you know, he goes to White House state dinners, travels all over the world, is because he really is able to say that I, Ray Dalio, have a system. I have an investment system. That's how I became rich. And I have a system for how I have, you know, conquered my own instincts that you too should follow. And look, he's not the only sort of famous wealthy figure who in recent years has decided that that even more so than being rich, what he really wants is, you know, to be liked and loved.
Yeah, or of material, of recognized, I guess, of same. I mean, you get some sort of the Elon Musk element there, right? I mean, where the guy's absolutely brilliant and is doing incredible things, but all of a sudden he's become this public persona. It's almost like this desire of to be relevant in the public discourse.
Well, Elon's kind of funny too, right? Because Elon I don't know exactly how to make an electric vehicle.
Right,
I certainly
right.
don't know how to make rockets, which for his SpaceX. I don't know how to implant chips in someone's brain as Neuralink. But yet what Elon loves to talk about is Twitter.
Yeah.
Which we can all relate to, right? I understand what Twitter is. I know what it's like to just talk constantly and give my opinion. So Ray is a bit like that too, in the sense that he never really quite says anything salient about investing or really anything specific about how to make money, but he has lots to say about, how to fight between these two sides of your brain and how to be, as he would say, achieve a meaningful life.
In your research, do you get a sense for, you know, what do you think made him ultimately maybe the most successful hedge fund manager
ever, possibly. I don't, or you know, there's what made him successful? What was the reality of what made him successful?
So this is sort of the oldest story ever told, and it's not just a Ray Dalio one, because when Ray talks about his upbringing and how he became so successful, he gives a pull myself up by the bootstraps story. You know, he says he grew up the son of a jazz musician. He lost his mother when he was young. He finds his way to Harvard Business School, and he starts this hedge fund, Bridgewater, out of his apartment. Now, that's all true, but what he leaves out of the story are these huge gaps where he ingratiates himself to a wealthy New York family and becomes their sort of surrogate son. They help him get his start on Wall Street. He marries into the Vanderbilt Whitneys, you know, maybe the most famous fortune in America. He also, for decades, learns that when you're already rich, the most appealing story to tell is that you are going to protect someone from losing their money. You know, hyper wealthy people often are very concerned with becoming poor. They're not necessarily as concerned with becoming even richer. And so Ray just tells this story over and over and over again about how he will protect you from ruin, that, you know, there's a doomsday coming around the corner, mm-hmm. and that Ray Dalio and Bridgewater Associates will save you.
What's kind of, I guess, okay, so let's talk a little bit about some of the things he talks about. Alpha versus beta returns. What's that all about?
Oh, gosh. And now that sound you just heard was everyone clicking the podcast off for Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend. So at alpha and beta is sort of one of those Wall Street jargons that financial advisors love to use to convince you why you need to pay them for help. It's actually a very simple concept. Beta is just the amount of money that you can make just by investing in the market, you know, just by buying U.S. stocks, a big sure. basket of every stock. That's beta. Alpha is sort of the extra juice. It's the extra amount that a talented stock picker, for instance, can make you over the market. Every stock picker or investment manager is going to tell you that they are very good at alpha.
Sure.
No one says I can't produce alpha.
Right.
The trick is actually finding and predicting the people who are going to produce alpha.
Right. So was there some special sauce that Ray Dalio had for being the alpha picker?
So particularly decades ago, in the 80s, 90s, and maybe part of the 2000s, Ray was very early to figuring out that having an investment system, having a set of rules, could be a very profitable way to make money, as opposed to, you know, being someone who just says, oh, my instincts and ideas will rule the day. You know, until very recently, actually, you could have very successful traders who claim to be able to read the tape, which is essentially they claim to be able to see the volume of stock trading and to sort of divine what was going to happen next. Mm-hmm. So to Ray's credit and to Bridgewater's credit, that was never how he claimed to make money. Now, over the past 10, 15 years, ironically, as Ray has become more and more famous, his funds have done worse and worse. And I don't think it takes a PhD to figure out the relationship there.
Yeah. What? And tell us what the relationship is. Is it just eye off the ball? Is it what do you think's going on there?
Well, there's no doubt that for the past, say, 15, 20 years, Ray's animating motive, his animating impulse has been to spread the gospel of himself and the principles. And behind closed doors at Bridgewater, he has shown absolutely no interest in learning anything new about investing. Keep in mind now, and again, I know that, you know, we're not talking to an investing audience here, but just imagine that you refuse to use email and you still sent letters back and forth. It's not that you wouldn't communicate eventually, but, you know, you'd have missed out on sort of the last 20 years of technology. It's not a bad analogy for what Ray has done at Bridgewater. He just sort of stopped developing and learning at some point because it was a lot more fun to travel the world and tell people about his principles.
Yeah. Okay. So now we've got the principles. We've got this character, this person that he has projected to the world, who's like, as you've discussed, is sort of this benevolent billionaire, wants to teach you how to do what he's done, the rag to riches story, and has all these principles behind them. And there, and I think what your book's about is this disparity between that story and what you discovered when you started asking people that worked with him. So tell us a little bit about what, you know, what that disparity was.
So key to the so-called principles, and I say so-called because Ray is always adding and subtracting to them. It's quite convenient, you know, whenever anything doesn't go his way, he's able to say there's a new principle now. He's just thought of it. And a key to this is something called radical transparency. He's become sort of very famous for this, where everything at Bridgewater is can be taped and viewed by everyone, so that sort of there's no such thing as a small problem, because we can always go back and rewind the tape and get to the core of things. Again, if I say this, it doesn't sound crazy, right? There's an appeal to that sort of surveillance. But what Ray does is he, using the principles, he starts to create these case studies of using these tapes where he edits everyone around him to basically look like a buffoon and edits himself to look like the savior, so that over and over again, he's able to show people, hey, if you had just embraced the principles, if you had just embraced my rules, we would have done things better. There are hundreds of principles, and I won't go over all of them, but I think the most salient one is one that he comes up relatively early, which is that at Bridgewater, people have to be willing to humiliate themselves to get at the truth. And it's fair to say that in the decade or so I've spent reporting on Bridgewater, I haven't found too many examples of Ray Dalio humiliating himself to get at the truth, but I have ample examples of others at Bridgewater who have been humiliated by Ray to, for, frankly, his pleasure.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. I love so many of these. Probably one of the strangest is that at one point Ray is using a whiteboard and he can't erase the marker on it. And rather than, you know, one, consider that maybe he might have picked up a permanent marker by accident, or two, you know, we've all gone through our day and small things can sometimes go awry, he starts this huge investigation of his facility staff, and he hauls in the head of facilities and they order every possible whiteboard on the market. And he's demonstrating, you know, how could you be so stupid as to order the wrong one? And this becomes a 6-week ongoing soap opera case at Bridgewater. And this is what so many Bridgewater employees will tell me. There's no winning these cases. You know, all you can do is sort of fall on the sword over and over and over again, humiliate yourself so that Ray can claim that you should have done your job better.
Right. And so was there, because of that, because I guess these humiliation and all that, was there a fair amount of attrition? And I mean, was there a lot of people moving in and out of that space? Or
there is. So there is a ton of attrition at Bridgewater, but I want to just go back to something that the principles prescribe a way for you to achieve a higher level version of yourself. So to give up, to quit, it's not just to get a different job, but also basically to say, I'm not interested in learning anymore from our charismatic leader. So it can be very hard for people, even over years, to realize that Ray's sort of investigations of them and his constant harping on their weaknesses might not actually be an attempt to help them in their lives. So many people who are there, whether for a day, a week, or 10 years, it's not until after they leave that they realize sort of how much time they just wasted.
Yeah, yeah. I'm curious on something, which is, you know, I don't follow him closely, but, you know, one thing that it seems to me that, you know, he reminds me a little bit of like Jim Rogers, George Soros' old partner, who's every time I, you know, see him, a video of him, he's talking about like the zombie apocalypse. You know, essentially it's a doom and gloom thing. Like, and this is pretty typical of you know, where his stance is. Most of the time I see him talking about how things are about to go, you know, to hell. And he seems to be wrong an awful long a lot of the time. And I'm not saying that, you know, listen, it's nobody, you know, nobody's that good at predicting the future, but he's supposed to be, right? So how can you be wrong that much and do so well in a hedge fund? I mean, I'm just curious on that.
Well, first of all, that was actually a reveal for me. When I was working on this project, I did something that I hope no one ever does again, which is that my research assistant and I went back and we read every media interview he'd ever given. And it turns out he's been predicting essentially the zombie apocalypse
right.
without interruption for 50 years. So when this goes, by the way, right up to the present, still very recently predicted a civil war in America, World War III.
Yeah.
It's probably his most enduring legacy is that he is a master marketer. It's not that different, frankly, from when you go bring your car into the shop and you think that the windshield wipers are broken and the mechanic says, actually, you need a whole new car and I'm going to sell you one. That analogy would have been better if it wasn't a mechanic, but a dealership. But right. I think people get what I'm saying. But this is what he's been doing and saying. So every 10 years or so, you know, the markets go in cycles. And every 10 years or so, there's going to be a downturn.
Right.
Ray is always able to say he predicted it. And then he just doesn't talk about the 9 prior years where he made the same prediction.
Right.
And everything turned out okay.
Yeah, there is that element. I think there's a number of people in the system that kind of, you know, that they rely on that old idea that, you know, even a broken clock is right a couple times a day. You know, it's interesting to put that together with, you know, the success, because I can see how that would work really well from the marketing play, as you were talking about before with, you know, ultra wealthy people. If you don't want to lose your wealth, that's your primary objective, to, you know, give your money to somebody who's hyper cautious and says, I know things are going to go south and I know what to do with your money. That certainly brings money into the fund, but then how do you turn around and make that, you know, make money on that? I guess the bottom line is that's the question is, he did do something, I presume, unless you can, you know, tell me otherwise, that seemed to be successful and, you know, that did seem to make people money disproportionately.
Sure. Now, remember that markets generally go up over time. That
right.
doesn't mean, this isn't financial advice. No one should put their money
yes.
in the market today and say, Rob Copeland said,
yeah, yeah.
I'll be rich. So although Bridgewater has failed to keep pace with the markets, they have generally had positive investment performance. So the real question for a Bridgewater client then is, how much of the upside am I willing to give up in order to have this ostensible downside? And remember that an investment manager is going to charge you a flat fee just for managing your money. So every year that you keep your money with them, they make money no matter what.
Right.
And a hedge fund like Bridgewater is also going to keep some of that upside,
sure.
some of that beta, as we talked about. So it can be less about actually making money and more about the marketing of getting you to keep your money. Who wants to pull your money from Ray Dalio's firm? I mean, he's world famous. He has TED Talks. He meets presidents. That becomes, frankly, more important than the actual details of what Bridgewater does or doesn't do with the money.
Yeah, fascinating. Okay, so you, he doesn't like this book that you wrote, right? So,
shocker.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Tell us a little bit about that. I think he's threatened you with some litigation, things like that. When did this start? And I'm curious, just like you're sitting in your apartment there and you go, oh, it looks like Ray Dalio wants to sue me. And that can't feel good, right? But yeah, tell us how happened.
Well, first of all, Ray is universally outraged by any journalist or employee or friend of the family who doesn't think that he's the greatest thing that's ever come down from the mountaintop. So I don't take it personally.
Yeah.
I will say when I first signed a contract for this book about 3.5 years ago, and Ray was the first person I told, because I wanted just to be above board. You know, I'm not looking to slink around here. And he immediately started threatening me before there was a word written. He hired first one law firm, then two law firms, then three law firms, They threatened me with a multi-billion dollar lawsuit, which was like a little bit amusing, to be honest, because
You'd even written a word?
Correct. They just had an outline that I had shopped to publishers, and threatening me with a multi-billion dollar lawsuit is a waste of, you know, a zero. You can threaten me with a multi-million dollar one. It has the same effect on me and my 20-pound dog, believe me. But he's gone to great lengths, considering that his principles are all about openness and so-called transparency and truth. He will do anything to stop people from saying their actual experience with him. At several points for the book, you know, people told me the scenes you're writing about, they were recorded. So why don't you just ask Bridgewater for a recording of them so that you can, you know, describe them? And Ray never seemed to get back to me on that. You know, we asked. I think he was counting on bullying and intimidating me like he has so many other people. But not to be super jingoistic here, the United States of America is a great place to be a journalist. It's a great place to be an author. And we've got the best laws on earth. As long as I am telling the truth, which I am, you cannot come after me just because it's unflattering to you.
Yeah. Although you can, and I think maybe what he was trying to do, and this is, you know, the legal system is very much, it's an expensive place to be. And you know, defending yourself and having to hire attorneys and all that kind of stuff. Have you had to deal with you know, a lot of those expenses or what have you?
Well, thank goodness my publisher is a major publisher, so they have First Amendment attorneys who are used to this. If I had to respond to his hundreds of pages of legal letters from three different law firms, I would have been bankrupt very fast. There is, if he actually did try to sue me, which he won't, I could countersue him for my costs, but you're absolutely right. It would squeeze me dry in a second. Anyone who was less than a New York Times or Wall Street Journal reporter who didn't have a book contract from a major publisher, you'd have no shot.
Now, my producer was telling me that you had actually, when you were coming out of college, you actually interviewed with Dalio's firm. Is that right?
I did. This has been one of his favorite cudgels. Uh-huh. He's been using this now for 10 years. When I was 23, actually, I, like many people, my first job wasn't my favorite job. And I interviewed at what must have been every firm in the tri-state area, in the New York area, hedge funds, banks, talent agencies, that sort of thing. And I interviewed at Bridgewater at 23. And I didn't get the job. I think I had two interviews. I don't remember anything about it besides that they were polite. And then later in my career, many years later, I became a reporter who was covering them. And Ray has been trying to use this against me for, I think, 7-8 years now. At one point, he went to the editor-in-chief of the Wall Street Journal when I was working there, and he threatened to release the recordings of my interviews. And the editor-in-chief said to him, if the reveal is that a journalist has considered higher paying work elsewhere at age 23, then go ahead.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, he wants to make it about me versus him, but it's really not. You know, I'm not a character in this book. I don't come in and save the day. This is about what he's like and what frankly, people who buy into his self-help mantra really experience.
So just to be clear, he's claiming that this is, you know, book in part was because you were angry that you didn't get a job or something like that? Or what
yeah, it's a,
what's the interview part of this? Did you say you said something stupid or like that? No, he can just embarrass says you
I
about?
Couldn't cut it.
He what?
Yeah, he says I've been on a 15-year crusade to because I did two interviews at age 23. What I kind of want to say is, well, I actually interviewed at so many places back then that if I've been on a crusade against every job I didn't get, I've got like hundreds of books to write.
Right,
I really got to get on that.
Right.
But at any rate, it's a distraction is what it is because he doesn't have the facts on his side. So, you know, that's what they do. They just attack.
Well, is there, so, you know, I guess from the take home on this, I guess the question is what can investors really like, I guess at any level, learn, if anything, from Dalio and Bridgewater, and from your experience in the book? Like, what can you take home from this if you are a, you know, retail investor? Maybe you're even, you know, at that level where you might be investing in a fund like Dalio's. Like, what is there take homes here?
Definitely, definitely. Well, first of all, I would say the book is mostly not about finance. It's actually a fun read. Uh-huh. It's sort of about what happens to people when they give up their own values and adopt that of their leaders. So I think that's a lesson for all of us, frankly. I hope it's assigned reading in high schools. On an investing standpoint, honestly, it is a good reminder that that you, the person who's giving the money, you are the product. So they're selling you. So when someone tells you they have a secret investment system that they won't show you, but you'll just have to trust them because they're rich, I would take a second look at that and make sure that that there really is a system. I think it's also a reminder that one good year, 5 good years, 10 good years of investment performance does not actually mean that much in the long term. That these huge firms, just because they seem very safe, that can actually distort their incentives. So, you know, since Bridgewater became the world's largest hedge fund, it has performed worse than most other hedge funds. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the biggest, safest choice isn't always.
Is it even beating the S&P 500? Nowhere close.
Probably no one who listens to this podcast has performed worse than Bridgewater Associates in the past 15 years. You're just not famous for it. There's a moment in the book when someone tries to challenge Ray. This actually happens twice. And he says, if you're so smart, why aren't you rich? And so to me, that is just a lesson for all time, which is if we're connecting wealth with smarts, then I think you're going to go down a very dark path very fast.
Yeah. And I think the lesson here too is, you know, I guess there's these different geniuses that people have, and try not to mistake one for another. Right. I mean, he's clearly got this, you know, marketing genius. I think there's a lot of people like that, right, who've got these tremendous abilities to bring people in their direction. But, I mean, do they have anything special to offer outside of their own charisma? Or is it just the charisma that you're buying into, right?
And absolutely.
Yeah.
And he loves to say that he doesn't care about money.
Yeah.
He loves to say he happens to buy the most expensive home in America, but he's just another regular guy. I am so skeptical now of famous business leaders who say that it just happened. It's just a convenient accident that they became rich.
Yeah.
I don't think that's intellectually honest.
Yeah. Yeah. Most business books kind of are, I always kind of snicker at them myself. So anyway, hey, this has been really fun to talk about, Rob, and you know, good luck with the book. It is the fund, Ray Dalio, Bridgewater Associates and the Unraveling of a Wall Street Legend. You can find out more about the book at bridgewaterbook.com/the-writer.
No backslash. Don't worry.
Okay. The writer. Yeah. All right. And obviously this is a book that can be purchased anywhere, Amazon, in the bookstore, all that kind of thing, right?
Correct. You can order a signed copy from Buxton Books in Charleston. They'll be thrilled for the plug.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. And let me know when the next time you write when you try to take down somebody else that didn't hire you.
That I interviewed. Rob, yeah.
Okay, right, Rob.
Thank you very much for having me.
Take care. Self-storage is a necessary evil. It's where you keep your stuff and forget about it. No wonder this stuff is so profitable and recession resistant. The Wealth Formula community, well, we've benefited from that. We've made lots of money in this space with Reliant Real Estate, one of the largest self-storage companies in the country. With an average investor internal rate of return of almost 34%, with hold times just over 3.5 years, these guys know what the meaning of velocity of money is. If you're an accredited investor, make sure to check out what they're up to right now. at ReliantFund4.com. Again, that's ReliantFund4.com. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Hope you enjoyed it. As a reminder, if you have not already done so and you are an accredited investor, make sure to go join that accredited investor list, investor club at wealthformula.com. Lots of exciting things coming down the pipeline. Lots of things that you will not see in the general emails that we get. So definitely go do that. And that's it for me this week on Wealth Formula Podcast. This is Buck Joffrey signing off.
Thank you for listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast. Visit us on the web at wealthformula.com. The information contained in this podcast are opinions, not fact. As always, consult your own financial team before making any investment. See you next time.
Buck Joffrey here from Sapio with Buck Joffrey. Aging might become reversible over the next 10 to 20 years. It's already being done in lab animals, so it's just a matter of time. Our challenge? To be healthy enough for when that time comes. As a former scientist and surgeon myself, my goal is to figure out how to do that and to share it with you. I wrote a book called Living Longer for Busy People that you can download for free at sapiopodcast.com. You'll be amazed at just how a few daily adjustments can add years of a healthy life for you. Again, download it for free, sapiopodcast.com.